history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories that need to be told. And sometimes if we just take the time to ask a few questions and listen a little bit, we will be amazed by what some of our elder statesmen have to say. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And today we're in Coronado, California, where if you say Hometown Heroes, maybe there's a few people who listen to the radio on 1170 and 1210 down here and listen to the program every weekend. But in Coronado, if you say Hometown Heroes, people think about the banners that line the streets here. And if you're on the corner of 3rd and J, you're going to see a Hometown Hero banner with a picture of Richard Hayward on it. And we're going to hear Mr. Hayward's story today. It involves the Army in World War II, 20 years as an Air Force chaplain, and a whole lot of twists and turns that we're going to try to cover in the time we have today. But Mr. Hayward, let's start early on. You grew up in Michigan.
Yeah, Pawpaw, Michigan is where I really grew up. I was 9 years old, and the newspapers were publishing newspapers at 2 o'clock in the morning, and then another one at noon. And I always worked for the guys with the noon paper so that I could go to school in the morning. And my parents, my dad came directly from England and didn't have any idea about America. And my mother was from a small family up in New England, and she didn't have any money. And they both went to college when I went to grade school, and they went through their college, 5 years of college, and then they decided to change to Mount Clemens. They owed the college $900, and I had saved $900, so I paid for their college.
From your paperboy money.
Paperboy money.
How many kids can claim they paid for both their parents' college with paperboy money? That's quite a story in itself. And that small town where you were living before, what was the name of it?
Pawpaw. P-A-W, P-A-W.
How big a place was that?
Oh, it was just a small town. It was at 18 miles from Kalamazoo. They used to go to Kalamazoo College, and they'd drive up there and go to college, and then I'd go to grade school. I kept the newspaper routes all the way through high school. But then the war started. I had graduated from high school in 1941. The war began. They only accepted people that were 20 years or older, and my mother said to me, I'm never going to sign anything for you to go to war, so just forget it. And then they took me to a small college where they thought it'd be nice for me to go through while the war was going on. And that college, I saw a sign that said, join the ARC. And I said, what's that ARC thing? And they said, oh, that's the Army Reserve Corps. I said, how do you join it? He says, every Wednesday night you go to a meeting for 4 years, and then you become a second lieutenant in the Army when you graduate. And I said, but there must be some way to get in the war. And the guy says, yeah, they've got a little clause in there that says, in case of a national emergency, the ARC will be called into active duty immediately. And of course, we were already in the war. So I said, give me that application. I took it home, and then I said to my mom, look, you don't have to worry about me. I'll be in an Army thing every Wednesday night, so you don't have to worry about me going to war. And she bought it, and she signed it. Then I turned it in, and then I went to war. I went to basic training 13 weeks in down in Texas.
Right away?
Yeah.
Well, what did your mother say when she realized you were heading off to basic training?
She couldn't do anything about it because it was all down black and white, and she'd signed it.
You pulled a fast one on her.
Yeah, I did. And she was mad at me, but that's all right. I wanted to go to war. And then I had some fun at the basic training. The sergeant would get us up out of bed in the morning and say, okay, we're going on a 5-mile hike before breakfast. And so we'd go full field pack for 5 miles and so forth. And then one time we had to learn to fire the rifle. They have us in groups of five down at the rifle range, and we had our target that we fired at. And then the sergeant came down and said, "Now, you guys have to realize that after you get through firing the rifle, you have to clean it before you can go to town." So I got the other four guys together and said, "Hey, let's all fire the same rifle, and then everybody can go to town except the guy that's got the rifle, and we'll change it from day to day so that everybody gets a chance at it." And then the sergeant realized what I was doing, and he says, "Hey, I'll make you my assistant, if you will, and you can stay right here and stay on the cadre and train the men going overseas." And I said, "I didn't join the Army to spend it in Texas."
Why did you join the Army? Why was it so important for you to pull a fast one on your mom and get in uniform?
Because I knew that our country needed us, and we needed somebody to go to war, and I was ready to do it.
But you're down there, and they say, "Hey, you can stay here, and you can just train the guys," and you say, "No, I want to go overseas."
Yeah, and they said, you're crazy, and they kept telling me that. But after about 2 or 3 weeks, they finally put me on orders to go to the South Pacific, and so I went to the South Pacific. Then I came into the 32nd Division. I was on the front lines for about 220 days total, I think, but it was over 2 or 3 years, I guess. The one time that really was horrible was when they got a machine gun and got it up above us. We were in our foxholes, and a foxhole is something different. The enemy's side of the foxhole, you dig a deep hole there where you can stand up and fire out in front of you. Then behind it, about 2 feet under the ground, we had a level place where we could sleep. We had to have somebody was guard duty every night. If he thought there was somebody out there, he'd touch our leg, and then we'd grab our rifles and jump down there ready to fire. It was kind of amusing after the war, because these guys went back and they married these gals back in the United States, and then the gal would touch their leg at night, and boy, everything went crazy.
Well, and you said that one time that was really bad, and I understand what I've read about you, thanks to the Avenue of Heroes here in Coronado and how they've honored you. In their description of your service, they said among those 220 days that you were on the front lines, there were 4 times that you should have been killed or wounded.
Yeah.
Well, tell me this. What was your welcome to the war moment? What was the first thing that you encountered over there?
Well, we went to a secure island there in the Pacific. The native there, he saw me, and there was a big oxen with big horns on it, and he put me up on it and took a picture of me. And so that was my first picture on the front lines.
And you have that picture here in your home in Coronado, and I'll put it on our website at hometownheroesradio.com. Everybody can see it.
Yeah.
But that's not combat yet. Where did you see your first combat? Is this in the Philippines?
It was in the Philippines. We fought up the Villa Verde Trail. And I was a rifleman. I was on the front lines,
From day to day, I mean, how do you prepare yourself for going into that kind of combat under those kind of conditions and that kind of weather against that kind of enemy?
Well, one thing, the weather was always good because it was hot, and I loved hot weather.
Coming from Michigan, I bet that was different
for you. So that was okay for me. And we always dug our foxholes in a circle so that we would all be firing out at the enemy. And sometimes the guy would, at night, would fall asleep, and then the Japs would come in and with their big knives and cut these guys up, and, I mean, kill them all. And
you saw that happen or saw the aftermath?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that doesn't give you much encouragement or solace when you're going to sleep at night.
I understand that, but that's what we did. We had to do it.
Well, let me ask you this, because your story is an Army story and an Air Force story, but it's also a story about your faith.
Oh, yeah.
And faith became your life's work as a chaplain and later a pastor. But when you went overseas, was that a big part of your life?
Oh, yeah. That was a big part of my life. My dad was in the First World War. He was born and raised in England. And after the war, England didn't have any jobs for these guys. And so he wrote a letter to a guy in Canada and another guy in Michigan. Said, you got any jobs over there? The guy in Canada says, if you're getting 3 square meals a day in England, stay there. And the guy in Michigan said, pack your bag and come on over because Henry Ford is hiring today. That was Ford Factory. So he came over and started working at Ford Factory, and then he ran into my mother, and she was a very religious gal. She wanted him to be a pastor like his father was. So she got him a little church here at Pawpaw, Michigan, with the idea that he could go to, that they both could go to college in the mornings, and they had every morning off so they could go to college.
So your dad did become a pastor.
Oh, yeah.
So this was in your blood.
Not only that, but my mother became a pastor, and that was back in the 1930s when women weren't pastors, you know.
Yeah.
And the big deal there was the blacks and the whites, you know, they didn't have churches together. They would be on separate churches. And she became the first pastor of a church in Lawrence, Michigan. And I went to church with the blacks and whites together. And this was one of the most wonderful things, I think, that happened. And I have a picture on my wall in my bedroom that I wake up every morning and see this picture of this church and remember that my mother was on the leading edge of that. And they really gave her a grilling when she wanted to be ordained, because they didn't want her being ordained. And they had about 6 or 7 ministers. They gave her all the questions they could think of, oral questions, for her to answer. And finally, after about 3 or 4 hours of doing this, one of the old guys says, well, what are we going to do with her? And the other guy says, you're going to ordain her. That's all there is to it. So they did. They ordained her. And she had this one church, and Dad had the other church.
So your two parents pastored different churches in different towns.
Yeah.
How about that? How many people can tell that story? And what I hear you saying is that your mother's church in Lawrence, Michigan was the first racially integrated church there.
Yeah.
How about that? What a legacy. Yeah. So when you went overseas, you had this belief that God was going to protect you? Or that if you were supposed to die, you would?
My dad gave me the 91st Psalm, and he said, read this psalm and be sure to do what it says there. And the 91st Psalm is where it says, trust in the Lord and he'll take care of you, and he'll take his angels and they'll come down and make sure that you're not bothered in the nighttime, and in the daytime the arrows will not fly your way, and maybe 1,000 will die in thy right side and 1,000 on the left side, but you will not be harmed. And so when I got into this horrible time when everybody's getting killed, I prayed and said, God, take care of me. I'm your man, living, dying, whatever. And then I went into a deep sleep. And when I woke, there was a bright sunshine and the guys were eating, and I was feeling pretty darn good. And God's been with me ever since.
And wow. And we're going to hear some of those examples of what makes you believe that. In your division, the 32nd Infantry Division, actually saw more days in combat in the Pacific than any other American outfit in the war. You weren't there for all of it. You got there. The island you were talking about where you are riding that ox is Morotai, right before you guys got involved in the Battle of Leyte in November of 1944. So here you are, a rifleman. In close combat with a determined enemy. And you said, you claim that 91st Psalm where it says, 1,000 may fall on one side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it won't come near to you.
That's right.
So give me some examples of where it came really close to you but didn't get you.
Well, one place I was standing next to a tree, and I just stepped aside, and at that moment, a bullet went in the tree right where I was standing, you know. Another time, a grenade didn't go off. It's supposed to, but it didn't go off, you know. And
how close to you?
Oh, just a few feet from me at that time. So, you know, just one of those things. And God was with me from that time on, all the way through my life. And he's been doing things for me. And when I became a chaplain, and my very first base that I had, I was a chaplain on. They needed a chaplain at the hospital at 8 o'clock at night. I went there, and their whole family was there. There was about 6 or 8 people, and the mother was in a coma. I had prayer with them, and I looked and saw this mother in a coma. And so I went, I thought to myself, after I finished praying with them, I went down, took her hand, and prayed for her, and told God to heal her. And then I left, and the next week I came back to the hospital, and I wondered who they'd put in her room. And I went in, and I said, I'm Chaplain Hayward. And she says, you're the chaplain that prayed for me. I heard your prayer, and I also heard God say he's going to heal me. And he did.
Wow.
That was amazing to me.
Amazing to a lot of people, I'm sure, especially to her. It's time for our first break, but there's more to come with 94-year-old Richard Hayward of Coronado, California. When we come back, more of his World War II experiences with the 32nd Infantry Division and a deeper taste of his commitment to others. He's a pretty gifted writer, too, and I'm guessing you've never gotten a Christmas letter quite like the one I'm going to have him read for us when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today spent 20 years as an Air Force chaplain, and in his retirement, 20 more as a pastor in the San Diego area. He still finds a way to minister to others through a phone hotline he set up, but none of those things would have happened if a young man from Michigan who tricked his mom into signing him into the military wouldn't have survived fierce fighting in the Philippines as a 21-year-old. Richard Hayward is 93 now. He is one of Coronado, California's hometown heroes, celebrated with a red, white, and blue banner on the corner of 3rd and J, if you happen to cross over that big arching bridge from San Diego. Among the hundreds of veterans who've joined us on this show are those from many different faiths. For some, religious beliefs are a small or even insignificant element to the stories they tell. On the other end of the spectrum are those who can't tell their stories without mentioning the divine influence they see. Mr. Hayward has quite a story to tell, and he's a gifted storyteller, quite a communicator. You'll find photos and video of him online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And before I jump back into my questions for him, I want him to read for us a Christmas letter that he sent out a few years back. We've all received our fair share of holiday cards and letters over the years, and I don't know about you, but I have never received one quite like this. He starts us off about 2 months into the brutal battle for Leyte, where he was fighting on the front lines with the 32nd Infantry Division.
World War II, we had failed. Darkness came before we could dig in and get organized. We lay down in a protective circle facing out. My two best buddies were gone. During a firefight, Paul had let out a scream and rolled back down the hill. What was left of his right hand was bleeding from a bullet. I bandaged his hand and sent him back to the medics. Charlie had gone over the brow of the bridge and dove for a shell hole as an enemy machine gun hit him in one arm and two legs. Chuck and I threw him some pills to stop the bleeding and began digging a shallow trench towards him. After several hours, we pulled him into the trench and got him out. The medics took him to the station, the aid station. During the past 2 weeks, the 39 men of our platoon had dwindled to 13, and there were only 3 men left in our squad. I began to feel the pain of being 10,000 miles from home and being all alone in the world. No one seemed to care. I'd seen a happy man, blood streaming from his mangled hand, running down the safe side of the hill, jumping and yelling for joy. I'm going home. The war's over for me. You poor devils are stuck in this living hell forever. Why wasn't I hit so I could go home? I felt my body all over, but there were no wounds. And would I get it tomorrow, the next day, when being killed or wounded seemed inevitable? I kept thinking, how bad could it be? I began feeling hopeless and afraid, and fear turned into terror. My throat went dry. My heart began pounding. I was shaking. I began crying. One word echoed in my mind. God, God, God. I got to my knees and I sobbed. Oh God, I can't take it anymore. I'm at the end of my rope. You take over. I'm your man, living or dying or wounded. I'm your man. Come into my heart and take over my life. Amen. All of a sudden, a peace came over me. I was completely relaxed. I felt like I was in God's hands. In my mind, I heard him say, "It's gonna be all right." I lay down and dropped into a deep sleep. The bright sun was shining in my eyes when I woke up. The other guys were getting something to eat. I felt good. It was great to be alive. I took my New Testament and the Psalms and opened them to Psalm 91. I began reading. He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God. In Him will I trust. Thou shalt not be afraid of the terror by night, nor for the arrow that flieth by day, nor for the pestilence that walketh in darkness, nor for the destruction that wasteth at noonday. 1,000 shall fall at thy side, and 10,000 at thy right hand, but it shall not come nigh thee. I wasn't afraid anymore. God was with me. 4 times during the 220 days, on or ahead of the front lines, I should have been killed or wounded. A sniper's bullet missed me and went into a tree where I had been standing seconds before. Another bullet tore the heel off my shoe as I dove for cover. An artillery shell that crashed into the ground 20 feet from me didn't go off. The day before Christmas, 1944, our company was ordered to move out to a hill 5 miles away where another American company was cut off, surrounded by the enemy, and running out of supplies except for food dropped from aircraft. We moved out early in the morning, single file. 100 men came down the hill, crossed an open meadow, and started up towards a wooded ridge in full view of the enemy. Outnumbered, the enemy seemed to vanish as we made our way toward the American company. Our platoon was first in line of march. Our squad was the eyes and the ears of the whole outfit. I was the first scout. We hiked up the ridge through the woods. After several hours, we came to a clearing 30 yards across. I remembered it as if it were yesterday. The struggling American soldier, his shaggy beard and dirty fatigues running down the hill toward us. He grabbed me and hugged me like a small boy grabs a lost puppy. And then he yelled, "My hat's off to you guys of the 32nd Division. You came to us when we couldn't come to you." We had broken through their ring of isolation and given them new hope, new strength, new courage, and new lease on life. We shared our rations and our experiences with them, and then we took positions in the empty foxholes on their perimeter. It was Christmas Eve, but Christmas lights were nowhere to be seen where we were. That year, instead of a gift in my hand, I found an M1 rifle. That year, the Christmas carols were the frequent booming of artillery shells. That year, instead of relaxing in a warm home in front of a Christmas tree, I shivered in a foxhole and looked out on the jagged remains of a huge old tree. Yet it was that year that I found the real meaning of the word Savior. You came to us and we couldn't come to you. God in Jesus Christ was my Savior. He had cut through my feelings of fear and terror and hopelessness and loneliness and depression to give me grace and love and joy. That's what Christmas is all about. Jesus is born in our lives. Those ancient words take on a new meaning. And the angels said unto them, Fear not, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, which is Christ the Lord.
I imagine a few copies of that letter had a few tear stains after they got sent out. Pretty powerful experience. And I want to follow up on some of that. You talked about the soldier who was so excited to get one of those so-called million-dollar wounds that would send him home. What was it about that, after 2 months of this daily horror on the front lines, that brought you to that spiritual moment you described?
Well, it was my father read the 91st Psalm. So I read the 91st Psalm, and it said in the 91st Psalm, the angels will take care of you. So I just put my faith in God. He took care of me.
And you told us about the time the bullet from the sniper hit the tree right after you moved.
Oh, yeah.
But there was another time where you got a bullet right in your boot?
Yeah. I was diving for a hole. It hit the heel of my shoe, you know. But it was all right. I was in the hole, so what the heck?
So it took the heel of your shoe off?
Yeah.
But it didn't wound you?
Didn't wound me, no.
That's close enough for me. Yeah. And you mentioned a grenade that didn't go off. Also, an artillery shell that landed about 20 feet from you?
Yeah.
But what happened?
It didn't go off.
It was a dud?
Yeah.
If it had gone off, what do you think would have happened?
Well, I'd probably been dead, wouldn't I?
That close.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a comfort in myself about it. Things were going to be all right. They turned out all right. And when I came back to the United States, I had to go to 4 years to college. And what happened was, when I was in Yamaguchi, Japan, I was taking my clothes from the front line down to my wash lady. And a buddy of mine was in the motor pool, and he was driving the commander's car. And he saw me struggling, and he told me to get in. I got in, and he was drunk as the Lord, and he was all over the road. And I was trying to get him to stop so I could get out, because I knew he was going to smack into something. And sure enough, he went off the road, went into a deep ditch and smashed the front end in. And then the guys came and said, you know, the war's all over now, so we're not going to give you the penalty you'd get during the war. We're going to give you the penalty we'd give you before the war, and that will be for you, both of you, to be in prison for 5 years. And then this army officer saw it, and he pulled me aside and said, I don't want to ever hear you say that again, because you're not going to prison. And what's more, I'm going to get you on the next ship out of here. Get both of you on the next ship out of here. I said, how do you know that you can do that? And he says, I'm a chaplain in the 32nd Division. He did it for me, and that's when I decided to become a chaplain. And so that I could do it for somebody else. Came back to the United States, and I went to USC and got the job in the afternoon, taking papers out to the valley out north of USC. I went through USC and found my wife, and she wasn't going to marry me. She wasn't going to have anything to do with me, because her mother was a divorcee.
And she told you that on your first date. She said, don't get any ideas. I'm not marrying you.
That's right. And so it took me a whole year to convince her, and then she finally married me. And I took her up to the seminary. The guy was running the seminary. He says, what's your wife going to do while you're going through seminary? And I says, well, my wife is going over to the University of California at Berkeley. And he says, well, it can't be done. It's never been done before, and it's never going to be done again. Nobody has ever been able to do it, even people here that are teaching for me would like to have gone over there, but they can't do it. And we left his house, and she was in tears, and I said, what are you crying for? And she says, because he said we couldn't do it. I says, well, don't worry about him. We're going to do it. And I put her on a ferry boat, gave her my car so she could take it over there. And that's what she did for 3 years. And then we both graduated and went in the Air Force.
You get done with seminary and you go into the Air Force, which at that point is only 5 years old. I mean, it was the Army Air Corps during World War II. They formed the Air Force in 48, and this is 53.
Yeah.
What was it about being a chaplain for the Air Force that attracted you, that made this seem like something you should be doing?
Well, it was because I could help other people. That's the whole idea. I could help people coming in the Air Force, because an Air Force chaplain had to see everybody that comes on the base, brand new, you know. I had a little talk that I gave them, and I says, if you want to have a wonderful life, then the first thing you have to do in life is to find some kind of a job that you really love and that you really want to do, and then you got to educate yourself for that job, whatever it is. Then you can find a wife that really appreciates what you're doing. That'll give you a chance to have a wonderful life. I used to tell them that, and 5 years after I left one base, I was ordered something at another base, and a guy says, hey, are you a chaplain? I says, yeah, I am. He says, were you a chaplain at this other base? Yeah, I sure was. He says, well, did you give us the talk about the great things that you have to do in order to have a happy life? And I says, I gave him that talk. And he says, well, my wife and I have done it, and we're in the fifth year, and we're having a great life. Thank you.
Music to your ears.
That's wonderful.
But I understand your first assignment overseas at a little radar station in Germany, you couldn't get anybody to come to
church
services on Sundays.
Because they all went downtown, and then they would come back, and they would sleep through. And
because they're out on the town Saturday night having fun. You moved your service to 1:15 in the afternoon?
Oh, yeah, I did that.
So how was attendance when you had church at 1:15?
Yeah. About 500% more.
Just had to think outside the box a little bit. It's time for another break, but when we come back, more from Richard Hayward's 20 years as an Air Force chaplain and how he still finds a way to serve others today at age 93. All part of what he sees as the reason he survived so many close calls in the Pacific during World War II. Check out the photos and video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We'll get back to Richard Hayward's story in a moment, but in listening to him today, I'm struck with some wide-angle lens realities of the kaleidoscope that 13 years worth of weekly visits with World War II veterans have provided. I'm amazed by both the diversity and the commonality. We've heard from veterans from every part of the U.S., every conceivable ethnic group, African American, Asian American, Native American, Latino, you name it, rich, poor, Democrat, Republican, everywhere in between, every branch of the service. And just in the weeks ahead, we'll hear from a 99-year-old dive bomber pilot, a female nurse from the front lines, and a Jewish Purple Heart recipient who lost his parents in the Holocaust. Holocaust but survived to become a pioneering scientist whose invention may just have saved your life. The spectrum of who these veterans are, where they come from, and what drives them today is an incredible mosaic united around that common thread of the American ideal. We may never reach that point where we perfectly model liberty and justice for all the time, but they sure have dedicated their lives to that pursuit. When we've talked to Baseball Hall of Famers here on Hometown Heroes, we've naturally included plenty of memories from the diamond. Likewise for square dance callers or school teachers or Olympians or retired generals. With today's guest, Richard Hayward, it is so clear that his life revolves around his Christian faith. So we're hearing a lot more about God than we normally would. Some of you may love that, others may be less comfortable, but the bottom line for me, with all our guests, is that they have the opportunity to share their true stories as they see them. We've heard about Mr. Hayward's time on the front lines with the 32nd Infantry Division in the Philippines, 2.5 months in the Battle for Leyte. He spent a torturous 6 weeks traversing the brutal 20 miles of the Villa Verde Trail in the Battle of Luzon. That fight would see 4 men from his division awarded the Medal of Honor. He told you how his war experience was the crucible from which a call to the ministry materialized, and one of the lasting reflections of his dedication and commitment to that call can still be found today in the Netherlands, where he served as an Air Force chaplain nearly 60 years ago.
The last Sunday of each month, I had to go to The Hague and hold a service for Americans in The Hague and anybody that spoke English, and they had about 100 or so, and they wanted a church. They were meeting in a hospital, and so I said, well, come down to the front after the service, and there was only 10 people came down to the front, and one of them was a bird colonel, and I was a first lieutenant at that time. The bird colonel said, well, you can see, chaplain, there's not enough people here to form a church. Just forget the whole thing. I said, I think we better pray about it and see what God wants and not what we want. And I called everybody up that had telephones for English, and I got them to pray for this church. And we found a church that somebody had put up for a whole summertime, and we got that church, and I got the instructions on how to get it up, and we put it up there, and they had a official greeting from the Holland government. They called it one of their treasures, and it's still there today. You can look it up. It's called the American Protestant Church of The Hague. You can see that it's still functioning today. So,
in fact, you went back there for the 50th anniversary,
yeah,
did you not?
I did. Yeah. It was great. It was a wonderful, wonderful situation. I had a base over near Albuquerque, New Mexico, top secret base at that time. And
oh, really?
There was 3 or 4 bases there. I got a radio program for them, a half hour, with the latest music and news and some kind of a spiritual message, you know. I did it for them and all the people that were on the bases. So that was another thing that I did. And then when I get 93 like I am now, I said, is there anything I can do to help anybody? And I decided that maybe there was. And when I had this little church that I helped was going to be closed, and I got them going again. And one of the ladies there recorded all those sermons, and she had them, and she gave them to me just about 3 or 4 months ago. And everybody told me you couldn't transfer that to the telephones today because of the computers now.
Yeah.
That they didn't have in those days. So I had to find a guy that would take them and transfer them. And now we've got a program going Monday through Friday. Every week, new message comes on every Monday. The toll-free number is 855-879-8918. And you can just call that number from any place in the United States and get these sermons.
So people call that number and they hear a sermon that you preached how long ago?
Oh, 20 years ago or so.
Because when you got out of the Air Force,
yeah,
and here you told us about being in Germany and the Netherlands, you're in New Mexico, which where people listen to this program.
That was all in the Air Force.
Yeah, and so I'm going through there. You even had some time stationed in your native Michigan in the Air Force.
Oh, yeah.
In Thailand during the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And then your last duty station was Vandenberg Air Force Base on the California coast, where we have some folks listening today as well.
Yeah.
So then you get out of the Air Force, and you come down here to Coronado.
Yeah.
You do public relations for the YMCA, but someone says, we're going to close this church unless we have someone to preach for a few weeks?
Yeah.
What happened there?
Well, they said, you're out of the Air Force now. You can take over this church for about 2 or 3 years, and we'll find a pastor for it. And so I did. I took over for 2 or 3 years, and the people loved me, and I loved them, and it grew, and we had a wonderful life, you know. Linda Vista Presbyterian Church.
Well, you were supposed to do it for as long as it took them to find a new pastor, but...
Yeah, but they didn't.
How long did you do it?
I did it for 20 years. And then I was 85 when I finally retired.
Well, now I want to go back to World War II with you, but while we're in the current times, so just a few months ago, you find out, hey, your city here, Coronado, is recognizing you as a hero, and they're putting your face on a big old banner that everybody who comes to this tourist attraction of a town and drives over that bridge from San Diego into Coronado, they're all going to see your face up on that banner of the corner of 3rd and J. What did that mean to you?
That was something, a real surprise, and I was really excited about it and happy about it that, you know, I live long enough to see something happen. The thing that's so horrible right now is that I go to bed at night, and then the next morning I get up, and during the night I've been sleeping and dreaming about some of the other things that I did in my life, and I look in the mirror, and there's that old man looking at me. It's really funny, because I'm getting so old, you know.
So in your dreams, you're a 20-year-old kid in a foxhole in the Philippines, and then you wake up and you're 93?
Yeah, that's it.
What can you tell me about the men you served with in World War II in that 32nd Infantry Division, so many of whom didn't come home? What were those guys like?
They were just similar to what I was like. They were trying to do their job. They were trying to do a job there to keep our country free and to get away from the Axis and all that thing, you know.
What was the hardest aspect of that, of being an infantryman in that part of the world at that time?
Well, I guess was the enemy. We were fighting the enemy, and the enemy was an individual soldier. And that's where it's so different from being on a ship or something like that, because on a ship, you're on a ship and they either get you or they don't get you. And when you're individuals, you don't have a choice in the matter. But we did it, so that was it.
You talked about believing that God would protect you.
Yep.
But when you look back, what would you say was the moment or experience or incident that made you feel the most frightened or scared or wondering if you were going to come home?
Well, that was when that machine gun, as I told you, was on us, all of our foxholes. And they were just picking people off like mad. And that's when we lost all those men. And it looked like everybody's going to get killed. And that was when I gave my life to God. And I said, hey, God, you take over. I'm your man, living, dying, whatever.
Did you have to deal with losing close friends?
Well, of course. I lost two buddies there. The three of us were in the foxhole together, and they got hit, and I got them down to the medics the best I could, and the medics did what they could because they were bleeding pretty bad. But we did the best we could for it, and that was it.
We talked about how close you came to being one of those 406,000 Americans who didn't come home.
Yeah, right.
How should those guys be remembered?
For the fact that they put down their life for what they knew we needed.
Were you ready for that? Were you willing to make that ultimate sacrifice?
Absolutely. That's why I was there, wasn't it?
I guess so.
Because I could have been in Texas. I could have just stayed with that sergeant and gone through the whole darn war in Texas.
Yeah. What did it mean to you when Japan surrendered, when all these days, you said 220 days of combat, where you really don't know what that day is going to hold or the next day, to hear that Japan has surrendered and this thing's over? What did that mean to you?
Well, it was great, because then I started thinking about what I was going to do in the future. Mm-hmm. And that's when I figured out that I wanted to be a chaplain so that I could be one of the men to help others that needed it in the Air Force, you know.
When you think back on that and you realize what you went through, and you said four times, not you could have been killed, but you probably should have been killed or wounded.
Yeah.
You know how many died. What are you proud of? What did you guys do that we need to remember today? What was the significance of that sacrifice of 400,000 American lives?
We were there to do the job, and we did it. And we were all dedicated to it. We wouldn't be there, would we?
No. And I've seen pictures of you in uniform. Got a lot of medals on that chest.
Oh, yeah.
There's a Bronze Star.
Yeah.
There's a Medal of Military Merit from your time in the Air Force.
Oh, yeah.
But the two that you have most prominent, the two decorations on that uniform that are above all the other medals.
Yeah.
There's a Combat Infantry Badge.
Right.
And there's something above that.
That's the cross.
The Chaplain's Cross.
Chaplain's Cross, sure.
What comes to your mind when you look at those two pins on your uniform?
Well, it's just that I know I remember what I went through and the fact that I became a chaplain and that I had a wonderful life. And my wife and I have had a wonderful, wonderful life.
What would you say you're most proud of?
Well, I was proud because I was working for the Lord to help other people. That's what I did all my life, was help other people. And that's what I did when I had the church. And that's what I had when I was in the chaplaincy. And I was always with people and helping them.
And you use the past tense there, but I don't think you've stopped helping others.
Well, I'm trying to keep helping them, but the only thing I can do now is let the telephones help.
Well, I'm sure that's helping whoever's calling into that number.
Yeah, that's true. 855-879-8918.
Most of the people listening right now weren't alive during World War II. They didn't live through the Great Depression like you did. They certainly didn't pay for their parents' college by the money they saved up from their paper route. But for those of us who weren't alive during World War II, who don't know what people like you went through, what you accomplished, or how you accomplished it, what is the most important thing that we need to know about that time in our nation's history?
We just have to need to know that we really loved our country and that we were doing it for our country and for everybody else that it influenced.
Well, and I don't want to forget to say something important. I want to say thank you. Thank you for your service to our country. And it's clear that your life has been about service, whether you are wearing a uniform or not. Have you ever thought about what if? I'm just thinking back. Your 20 years as a chaplain, I imagine you touched the lives of countless servicemen who were facing some pretty serious things in their life.
Yeah, that's true.
All over the world in these different duty stations.
That's right.
And then 20 more years as a pastor after that.
Yep, that's right.
How many lives did you touch? Even now, with this phone recording, who knows who else you're reaching? But what if those close calls, at least 14 of them you remember in the Pacific, what if one of those was the one that got you? Have you ever thought about that?
No, because I didn't get it. It's just like some people making up their minds that something bad's going to happen no matter what. Something bad doesn't happen, and then where are they? They're way out in orbit, and they're not doing any good for themselves, that's for sure.
But just from a probability standpoint, you saw it happen to so many other guys. Yet, the bullet hits the tree, not you. The bullet hits your heel, but not your foot. The shell lands by you, but doesn't go off. The grenade lands by you, but doesn't go off. All these things that you survived so all these other things could happen. How do you explain that?
I don't explain it. I just say it happened that way, and that's all there is to it. I was doing what I could do, and that was it. You have the Lord with you. God's with you. God's with you right now. He's going to be with you as long as you live. He's going to be there no matter what. And if you have a problem, take it to the Lord and ask Him to help you. And God will help you. There's no question in my mind that everybody can be helped if they want to be helped.
How long have you and Betty been married now?
66 years.
What's your secret?
We love the Lord our God, and then He's with us. And He takes us and He directs our life and He helps us in our problems and He helps us with whatever we're trying to do. And I'm happy and I've got my wife and she's going through some real difficulty now, but we're going together with it. So she's got some cancer and we just came from the doctors and they said they can't do anything for her. They can't operate or anything because of the cancer, the kind of cancer she's got. So I pray with her every day and do what we can do to make her comfortable. That's about the best we can do.
You know, that brings to mind a thought too. With all those years as a chaplain, and I've got a lot of friends that are chaplains, and I know how much they care and the burdens that they carry and the heart that they have for the men and women who they serve. What advice would you have for someone who's in that role now, who's a chaplain in our armed forces today, dealing with these men and women who are risking their lives for our freedom?
The same thing as I did before, and that is be sure and let them know that God is there for them. All they need to do is call on him and say, "Hey, God, help me. I need some help here." And God will help them.
Well, it is impossible to miss how sincere those words are and how strongly he truly believes that. Richard Hayward, 93 years old, of Coronado, California. Those photos are up at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, but we're out of time here on the radio for now. I'm Paul Leffler saying thanks for listening and inviting you to join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.